I did.
How difficult was it?
Difficult? Why would it be difficult? Didn't you say you only had 10% deposit for your house?
10% is enough if Mortgage Masters is helping you with home loan.
Mortgage Masters can also help you with refinance or with any rental and commercial property related question. Contact Nathan Saminathan now, a certified financial planner and authorized financial advisor with over 30 years of experience in New Zealand. Call now.
नमस्कार आणि स्वागत करता हा तुमका रिची आईच्या सुशेका तनपार रेडिओ प्रोग्रामार. आज आमच्या स्टुडिओत आमचा गेस्ट असा मायकल पुट, हुज द MP फॉर द माउंट रॉस्कल इलेक्टोरेट फ्रॉम द लेबर पार्टी. आणि त्याच्या संगात चर्चा आणि उलोंग ग्रेस सराव अँड झेवियर ब्रिगेन्झा. वेलकम टू आवर प्रोग्राम माइक.
नमस्कार, गुड आफ्टरनून.
थँक्यू. थँक्यू. डिड यू अंडरस्टँड दॅट सॉन्ग मो कुडो?
Oh, well, I was told while we were waiting that it was a song about love.
That's right.
I'm sure this interview is going to be infused with the spirit of love.
Oh, wonderful. So it all said that love is blind. It doesn't look at who you are, black, white, your money, no money. And this is the man who promises that he will look after the daughter of this man, irrespective of what his condition is. So you got elected, Mike, at the last general elections from the Mount Roskill electorate. And as I see that you are the undersecretary to the Minister of Ethnic Communities, what is this ministry and what is your role there?
So in my role as an undersecretary to the Minister for Ethnic Communities, my role is basically to assist the minister, and that's the Honourable Jenny Salisa, who is the minister. And to implement the direction of the government, we have what's called the Office of Ethnic Communities. It's not a full ministry. It's an office which is attached to the Department of Internal Affairs. And broadly speaking, what are we trying to do in this space? We're trying to make sure that New Zealand's ethnic communities have a real voice within government and that people are able to achieve their fullest potential in this country. And so it's about picking up on the issues that matter to ethnic communities. It's about making sure that people in ethnic communities are well represented, that we're hearing the voice within government and then acting on the things that we need to do.
So isn't it just sort of a double-edged sword? Because then you sort of ring-fencing this community, trying to put too much focus, and it becomes doubly difficult for them to integrate with the mainstream. How do you sort of balance the two out?
Yeah, I hear what you're saying there. And certainly when in the work I do with ethnic communities, people don't want to be put in a box separate from the rest of society. People want to be able to contribute into society, be a part of society, but often to retain their unique cultural backgrounds. And so it's about trying to get that mix right. And also recognising that sometimes for people to be able to contribute in society, there might be particular barriers or issues. And let's work together on those things so that people can be fully contributing citizens. So, you know, what's an example I can think of there? Well, we have some communities for whom language is a barrier. Mm-hmm. So, and, you know, if you don't have good English in this country, it is very difficult to go out into the job market and get a role and deal with government agencies and all of those things that you need to be able to live a good life for you and your family. So how do we work on those sorts of issues?
So you need good teachers for that, right?
We definitely need good teachers. I wonder if you're thinking of anyone in particular, Xavier.
But yeah. Xavier, you teach only physics and maths.
Well, because, we need teachers, and they do play an important role. And as you said, one of the problems with ethnicity groups that when they come in here is the language barrier. But what other issues are there that your minister is dealing with?
Yeah, a range of issues. So let me name one, and it's one that we're doing some work on at the moment. There are real issues for ethnic communities in terms of having voice in our system of government. So Jenny Salisa, as the Minister, has led some work recently looking at the diversity of people we have on our state sector boards. We have literally thousands of boards that the government appoints people to make important decisions in our community. And despite New Zealand having been a very diverse society for quite a long time now, we have very, very, very few ethnic community voices on those boards. And it's not because there's a lack of talent or a lack of education or anything in the ethnic communities. It's just because our systems haven't connected with the
communities. So it's a lack of awareness.
A lack of awareness, I think, at the end of government and at the end of communities, and a lack of bringing the two groups together. And probably in some cases there's historically been some discrimination. You sort of get used to looking for people from the same groups. And so we haven't got New Zealand properly represented across that area. And I think as a result, New Zealand misses out on the experiences and the skills and the attributes of those ethnic communities. So we're doing some work in that area at the moment to make sure that we have those boards looking like New Zealand actually is.
So just based on what you're saying now, Michael, and that sounds really good. So if our listeners want to get involved in this, particularly the youth, do you all have open days where people can come to or have additional information so that they can come out and get involved in these kind of initiatives?
Increasingly, the answer is yes. We're trying to run forums and events and engagements to really connect up with different communities. So last Sunday, for example, my colleague and I, Priyanka Radhakrishnan, our Labour List MP based in Maungakiki, ran an event in Sandringham for some of our young ethnic community leaders. These are young people mainly in their 20s who are making a real contribution in their communities, in business, doing good things for the community. And we got those people together in one room so that they could link up with one another, so that they can understand how they can contribute into what we're doing in government, and that we can empower them to be successful leaders. So we are increasingly doing that kind of work. Another example, going to education, we've recently had what we called an education conversation, where we, as government, went out to the community and said, what do we want our education system to look like in 30 years' time, and how do we start the work to make sure that it's meeting the needs of New Zealand in 2018 and in the years to come? Specifically as a part of that, we made sure that we had forums for people from ethnic communities to participate, so that we were hearing that voice coming in to shape the policy that we're making.
Okay. So one of the questions that has come from Aston De Silva, one of the listeners, he's saying that most ethnic groups are very cohesive in terms of their family ties, both here and overseas as such. For some time, this family reunion visas or permanent visas have been suspended. Are there any possibilities of a change or a rethink on that from the Labour government?
I get asked this question quite a lot, and you can imagine in my role and also as the MP for Mount Roskill, it's quite a hot topic. This change happened in late 2016 under the previous government, and they really tightened up on it, and it's almost impossible now to get that family reunification. And you have a lot of people who, you know, really worry about their elderly parents, maybe, you know, quite isolated, living back home. You know, the people are good citizens here in New Zealand, they want to look after them, and the system doesn't allow for that at the moment. It's something that I've been consistently advocating, that we have an approach to reopening up that category, and I've been advocating that to our Minister, Ian Lees-Galloway. He is currently doing a review of a whole range of the immigration settings, and this is one of the areas that is being looked at. So I'm not in a position to give a guarantee on the show here today, because the Minister's looking at that. But I think by probably early next year, we're going to have a set of announcements around immigration policy, and there should be a direction in this area. And it's certainly something that I'm encouraging the Minister to try and make some movement in. There has been some concern in the past that not a majority, but a small number of people have used that system to bring parents in, sort of dump them, and then head off to Australia or somewhere. Not a majority, but a small number. And so if we do move to re-establish that visa category, we'll want to make sure that we have some provisions in place that discourage that sort of activity, because that's not good for anyone.
It's quite reassuring, I must say. It's quite reassuring.
It is.
Yeah. And so there's a rethink on it. So, Aston, I hope there's some sort of hope that the Minister or the Undersecretary is giving us as such. So that's as far as ethnicities are concerned. Anything specific?
I'd like to ask about the workforce. You know, there's a ban on getting people to work here, and now there's a demand because there's so much of a shortage, and things are not really moving. So what, are the doors going to be open again? Or
It's a really big challenge. We've now got unemployment down to 3.9%, very, very low. And one of the biggest challenges that employers actually have in New Zealand is exactly what you're saying, is just getting enough skilled staff to fill important roles in their businesses. And that's really what our immigration system, what's one of the things that our immigration system should be doing. In my view, our immigration system should be basically about two things. One is meeting the workforce demands of New Zealand, and one is a humanitarian aspect. Now, on the workforce side, our view is that the system to date hasn't really done a great job of that. In some cases, yeah, we've been having a very high level of immigration over recent years, but we've still had employers who aren't getting the people in that they need. And then at the same time, in some sectors, we've been bringing people in and just putting them into low-skill, low-income jobs that they don't find very satisfying as well. So in the work that the Minister's doing, he's trying to repurpose the system so that we meet the needs of the immigrant and we meet the needs of employers here more precisely. And the direction that we've signalled there is by looking really closely at the specific needs of each region. And so our needs in Auckland are going to be different to our needs in Hawke's Bay or in Southland. And then working with employers in each of those regions and getting the matching going on in an accurate way. So that's the direction we're heading in. And as I say, the Minister will be announcing a broader series of changes probably early next year, which will deal with the specifics of that policy.
Yeah. So just following up from that, obviously the Labour Party came in with certain, objectives on their manifesto. And we want to talk about a couple of those. Housing affordability, obviously, because it's on everyone's mind. And the second one is child poverty, because you'll have some really ambitious targets on that. So let's start with housing affordability. We've heard a lot about the Kiwi build, etc., but we still face the situation where people cannot get in, particularly people with one income and stuff like that. Have we got the benchmark of affordability correct? And what is the Labour government planning on doing in the next 2 or 5 years to ensure that we can make it further affordable for people who don't have two incomes or, you know, struggle to get a 20% deposit?
It's a great question. And there's no doubt in my mind that, you know, when Labour came into government last year, the single biggest issue in the campaign had been housing affordability. And, you know, it just goes to, you know, the most basic things in life. If you want to, you know, set up and raise a family and live a good life, you need a decent, affordable house. That's just one of the basics, along with food and clothing. They're the basic needs that humans have. And we had a situation where we had a housing market just completely out of control. We'd completely lost the human values in terms of the value of housing, and it all become about speculation. And that's just wrong, in my view. And it was leading to terrible outcomes. So a big challenge that we've faced, and it's been heading in that direction, the wrong direction, for a long time. So it's a big focus for us. What are the things that we've been doing in that space? Well, the first one, and you've mentioned this, has been getting Kiwi Build up and going. And we do now have it up and going. It takes quite a long time when you come in government to set up a whole new program and actually get the policy working and then start to, you know, this ambitious plan to build 100,000 affordable houses over 10 years. It has started now, and we opened up the first Kiwi Build houses in Papakura about 1 month ago, and the first families have started to move in there. We're going to build 1,000 of those in the first year, 5,000 in the second year, and then it will ramp up to hit that target of 100,000 over 10 years. They're much more affordable houses than the market provides. So for three-bedroomed houses, the maximum price is pitched at $650,000.
So why have not many people applied for it? Because it's not as been as successful as you all thought it would be, right?
No, I think there's been a little bit of a political mischief around that. So we had an example, I think maybe in Queenstown, where the ballot wasn't completely full.
Wanaka as well?
Yeah, but the houses hadn't actually been finished yet.
Okay.
So it wasn't actually like there was a big problem. It was quite an early stage of the process. Yeah, and Papakura, we certainly had no problem with that, by the time the houses have been finished. I have no doubt. Yeah, there is a huge demand in cities, particularly Auckland, for more affordable housing. And I would be astonished if we don't have the demand to meet those houses. We have a project in Mount Roskill at the moment. We're going to have several hundred Kiwi Build houses coming in there over the next few years. And what we're also doing with Kiwi Build is giving what we call local preference. So people who actually live in the community where the Kiwi Build houses are being built will have the first shot at getting them as well. So that is going to start to affect the affordability. We've already seen the banks with Kiwi Build. You mentioned, yeah, the barrier of getting a deposit, a 20% deposit. Some of the banks are offering 5% deposits for Kiwi Build houses because it's a much more secure investment for the banks. So that really starts to bring the barriers down. And the other bit of work that Minister Twyford is doing in this area is on what's called shared equity, where, okay, say the Kiwi Build house is $650,000 and, you know, maybe you need a 10% deposit, that's $65,000. And for some people that will be possible, for some that's still a big stretch. With shared equity, you can effectively go in maybe with a 50-50% share with the government, and suddenly you have effectively the equity stake that you need to get in there. And then in time you can buy it out from the government. So we're looking at a whole range of options to bring those barriers down and give people access to housing again. And we think it's starting to work. So we have started to see the average price, it's still way too high, has eased off over the last year. The Reserve Bank has started to reduce the loan-to-value ratios, and they've said partly that's because of the government's reforms of bringing more supply into the market, starting to ease prices. So it's early days, but we think there are good signs here, but we've got a lot more work to do, and our big job is the housing supply, getting those houses built.
I think that brings me to my next question, right? Constantly there is rhetoric about in New Zealand we pay close to 30 or 40% higher cost for building. And recently Mr. Tindall's come out and spoken about it rather openly and in a way has brought it up to the government and said, do something about it. I know you all have kicked off a Commerce Commission inquiry on fuel. Are there any plans to do a similar exercise with housing and how are you all proposing on, you know, making sure there are no monopolies in that area?
Yeah, well, there are a few big costs which feed into housing. One is the biggest one is actually the land. It's not actually the materials. And the way we're looking at dealing with that is through, you know, reforming some of our planning laws, but also making more efficient use of our land. So the truth is, in a bigger city like Auckland, we're going to have to build up a little bit and not keep spreading. That's going to reduce the price by making more efficient use of the land. Part of it is the materials, though. And I think some people have probably seen in the newspaper recently, we've had these comparisons, basic building products in a Bunnings in New Zealand and a Bunnings in Australia. And it can be two or three times as expensive. Yeah. Same product. That doesn't seem right. So what the government has done, and you know, the opposition opposed this legislation, is given the Commerce Commission what are called market studies powers to go in and look at sectors of the economy where we think there might be uncompetitive behaviour and do a proper study, requires the industry participants to open their books and to actually front up with the information we need to make those determinations and then to recommend changes to government that might need to be made. Now, the first one we've done there is the fuel market, which has been an issue of big concern, and we may even talk about it later. The Minister's indicated, look, there are several other areas that we could look at, the supermarkets, building supplies and others. So that's certainly a possibility. We've now got the legislative framework to do that. The other thing I just wanted to mention briefly is we're also looking at prefabrication. How do we bring the price down? This is basically building houses in a factory, and it's what they do in places like Germany, and that's where you get the scale coming through, and that's what Kiwi Build will allow.
I think the heat is building up, Mike, so let's take a break and listen to some music.
That's quite encouraging, though. That's good.
Mogu boy lo iwaria. As we need. sido nuestro abrazo, hogar de tu alma. Y hoy te marchas, pareciera sin pensarlo. A retoños que irán por la vida sin ti, buscando tu regazo. Son dream leaf blow, cupat morbar, wilson ambla tu ver con un chitlo y furar. Ula sonda, sobe mazar, coso pusundaco por la yeguotar. Devan tu cafilis duru, burgi curta trozar.
Cun bien survat che li aga lungsa so pot ai le rata raja so pot ai le rata fartore c'ha cun bien survat che li aga lungsa so pot ai le rata raja so pot ai le rata.
नमस्कार तुम्ही ऐकतात सुशेगात दनपार प्रोग्राम कोंकणी रेडिओ प्रोग्राम 104.6 प्लॅनेट एफएम आवर. बिफोर वी टूक द ब्रेक फॉर कूलिंग ऑफ द डिस्कशन एज सच, दिस इज अबाउट construction and the Kiwi build as such. So just taking off from what Xavier said and what Grace was talking about, Xavier talked about can we get immigrant laborers to meet the shortage, because we are currently running at almost 3% unemployment and you don't have really labor in the market as such. And on the other hand, you have an ambitious plan of around 10,000 houses to be built. So how are you going to achieve it? And then you have a cartelized construction industry, which is sub-layered as such. So how is this going to be addressed? And you have coalition government partners who are against immigration. So how are you going to bring the price down? You can't get in labor, you can't dismantle the cartelism, and you can't have coalition government partners who are playing ball with you.
It's a very difficult set of issues that we've inherited in this space. And
something both Phil Twyford as a Minister for Housing and Urban Development and Jenny Salisa, who's a Minister for Building and Construction, are grappling with at the moment. You know, looking at the migrant labour situation, clearly there is a need within the sector for us to have migrant labour to support the build programme that we have. You know, there are a couple of things that go alongside that, though. One is that we've got a strong view, along with our coalition partners, all of us, in fact, that system's been abused at times, and we're not going to have a situation where we have migrant labour coming in at, you know, below rate costs and basically being abused. That's not a moral use of the system. The second thing is, though, that under the previous regime, we were often using migrant labour to plug gaps with no long-term plan about how we're actually going to build up capacity. And so we're going to have a much greater focus on apprenticeships and trades training to actually get young people in. You can have a great career in the trades. So, for example, with a fees-free policy, okay, you get 1 free year if you go to university or polytech. You get 2 free years if you go in to become a building apprentice. So we're trying to do work to encourage young people in New Zealand to the sector as well. So there are quite a few work streams in there to recognise that difficult issue that we've got. The other big one, which I touched on before, is the prefabrication. We think if we set up prefabrication properly, that's going to make the whole sector of building houses much more efficient, both in terms of capital and labour costs. Bit of work to do to get that up and going, but Kiwi Build gives the possibility, because if you're a big international player in this market, you need security of supply. You need to know if you're going to set up a house building prefab plant that you're going to be able to put a lot of houses through it. Kiwi Build tells that sector there's not going to be boom bust. We're going to be pumping out 10,000 houses a year. So I think that's going to be one of the big breakthroughs as well.
So will the government extend any R&D credits towards these new companies that come in and say we can help you with the build?
Well, we have the new government is, and the legislation's about to go through the House, establishing the research and development tax credit. We last had one when Labor was in government previously. National abolished it. And any company that has new and innovative techniques that are genuinely research and development will be able to get a tax credit under that system. So if we do have companies in the prefab space who are doing genuinely innovative stuff and it qualifies as research and development under the tax rules, then the answer is yes, that will be incentivised activity. So that potentially is another way of supporting this kind of activity, as well as the more general economic uplift that we need from more high-tech investments.
Great.
So let's get to Grace's other question. She talked about housing. We can continue discussing for the next 5 hours and still we may not come anywhere close to it. Child poverty. This was a big issue during election time. And it's linked to ethnicities as such. So what's the government doing about it?
Huge issue. And, you know, most of us, I think, feel very deeply across political boundaries and everything else that in a country like New Zealand, we should not have kids growing up in poverty in a way that stunts their God-given potential. It just shouldn't happen in this country. But it does. The Prime Minister has taken that on personally. She's made herself the Minister for Child Poverty Reduction, and she has put her mana and her authority into that area. There are some short-term things that we've done and then some longer-term things that are on the way. The shorter-term things revolve around the families package. So this was our alternative to National's tax cuts. Under the tax cuts National wanted to put through, I would have got a nice little tax cut. I don't need it. I'd much rather that money went into child poverty. And so that families package did things like lift the average income for low and middle income families, about 380,000 families in that bracket, by $75 a week. It gave a winter heating allowance to our older citizens, but also our people who are on benefits, who often you have a lot of kids in very difficult circumstances, getting sick because they couldn't afford the heating. So quite a bit of support's gone in there. The bigger story is the Child Poverty Reduction Bill that has just been introduced to Parliament. And what the Prime Minister has done this year has been to work to get cross-party consensus on that, which has been a major achievement, and she's now got the National Party on board. So we now have a situation where the whole Parliament is coming in behind this legislative approach, which will put child poverty reduction targets into our budget, and every year we will have to report against those and show what we are doing to reduce child poverty. So lots of work to do, but we've made major progress this year.
So do you have any numbers to tell our listeners as to what it was and what it is today?
Yeah, I don't have them now, but that's what this bill will do.
Okay.
It will actually set short-term, medium-term and long-term targets that will be very transparent and government will have to report against. This is a part of how we want to basically redesign the way we do the budget. At the moment in the budget, we report, have we got a surplus or a deficit? That's important. Have we got economic growth? That's important. But those things are just means to an end. We should actually be focusing on the well-being of our people and our communities. And so we're going to be reporting on things like rates of homelessness, child poverty, how many people are getting education, those sorts of things in our well-being budget, which we're starting off next year.
So recently or a few days ago, there's a big change. In fact, Labour government has gone about this big changes, big bang theories and policy change, big shifts as such. The recent one is in the education sector. Xavier.
Yeah, we just, one of the policies of the standards and the policy of the NCA. So what's exactly your thinking on that?
So national standards and NCEA, we had a very clear policy at the last election, which we campaigned on and would campaign for a number of years, that actually we saw national standards as a big distraction within the sector, created huge administration and workload for teachers, and actually weren't really national standards at all, because they often varied quite a lot between schools. And I sat on a school board of trustees for a number of years and saw this firsthand. So we actually want schools to be able to focus on teaching, to be able to focus on assessing against the curriculum, and we think that's a far better use of their time. NCEA, it was a system that was brought in over a number of years under both National and Labor governments, and basically we think it has strengths, but we think it does need a good review, working closely with the sector. So that's the approach
that
we're taking
now. That's going on now. We're part of that. Yeah. But how do you compare it internationally when you want to talk about Cambridge and other... the IE and all that stuff?
Well, NCEA clearly is a system that is, it has its proponents and its opponents. It's a system which clearly is more flexible. The other systems, and I went through the old bursary system, School C system. You studied through the year on a particular paper. You might have had some internal assessment, then there's the Big Bang exam at the end of the year. NCEA clearly allows students to sort of dip in and out a little bit more. To access qualifications, if you're having a good year at year 11 or 12, you can potentially, if you're year 12, you'd normally be doing level 2 stuff, but you might be able to access some level 3.
Yeah.
So I think that flexibility is valuable. There are some people who oppose the system who say they don't think it gives really clear standards and it's open to manipulation and this kind of thing. I think some of those concerns are a bit overblown. But what we're saying is let's sit down with the sector and work collaboratively to make sure the system is as strong as possible. So we haven't predetermined the outcome there, but we just need to work with the sector, students, parents, teachers, professionals, and get the best possible system.
I just want to go back. I know we dealt with this workforce thing, but you were talking about, the first time free, the second time free. Now, to my mind, that's like issuing lollies, but you're not really getting quality there because you're forcing them to be motivated. And we're not really getting the actual motivated builders or the actual motivated people who want to study or to learn. So I think that's kind of dumbing the I wouldn't say dumbing, but kind of bringing a lackluster to the quality of the product.
Sure. I guess what's the principle which sits behind the first year free policy? It's our view, and it's always been a Labor Party view, that education is something that is liberating for people, that allows them to reach their potential. And we should have as few barriers in the way as possible. And we certainly do know that there are people, and it's particularly kids from lower socioeconomic backgrounds often, for whom there are already quite a few barriers to really pushing through the education system. And we just think as much as possible we should be reducing those barriers. The other thing with the system is that at the moment we actually end up paying quite a lot setting up a fee system and then a subsidised loan system. And so actually there's a cost within that already. Yeah. So in some sense it's just...
comes from the taxpayer.
So in some sense the fees freeze actually just a bit more efficient. But also we can use it, as I say, to actually incentivise where we think we need to incentivise. So as I said, 1 year free if you go into university or tech, but we've got a massive gap in terms of trades, training and apprenticeship. So we've incentivised that a bit more by saying, well, that's 2 years free. And those people are still going to have to work really hard on their qualification to get over the line. But it does take away the barrier of cost.
So talking about trades as such, this very institution on whose grounds we are sitting is currently under administration. And so there has not been much investment in some of these trade-related activities. In fact, some of the programs at Unitech have been shut down.
Yeah.
So what's the way out?
Well, look, I sat on the council at Manukau Institute of Technology for a number of years, a wee while ago now. So I have a bit of familiarity with this area. Look, for too long, trades have just been the poor cousin, actually. And I think that politically and also sort of culturally in New Zealand, we have sort of diminished the trades, and we have this expectation of our kids to go to university and do engineering or do law or whatever. And those are good professions. I'm not dissing them at all. But actually, you can have a great career, earn a good income, make a fantastic contribution being an electrician or a plumber or a builder. And they're essential skills for the country. And we've just sort of, that whole system's been completely decentralised. I don't think there's ever been any real plan around it. And we have the result now. We have massive shortages in all of these areas. So we've actually got to, I think, have a little bit more collaboration at the centre around this stuff and then work with the industries to really understand their needs and get the right number of people coming through. But that will take some years to rectify that balance. Yeah. And then we've got to work with the institutions. Big problems across the whole polytech sector. I mean, Unitech, obviously, and with the problems we understand at the moment, and we're having to bail out the institution, but others as well. So we've got to really work with that whole polytech sector to make it sustainable.
So would it be right to say that, hey, listen, don't focus too much on foreign students because it helps you to make it more financially viable, but try to focus on something which is required by the economy, required by the industry, and required by the policies, economic policies as such?
It's a really interesting question. And of course, what the institutions will tell you is they'll say, well, actually, we need those foreign students because they bring in revenue, which we then pump into the other stuff. You rightly raise the point, well, maybe that means you don't have the right focus in terms of what you're actually delivering.
Yeah.
I don't think there's a simple way through that, but I think it's a good question, and it's one that's worth addressing with the institutions.
So let's take a small break and listen to some music.
Kelia, poilo mo tan kazai, u prantu mi.
তুমি ঐকতা সুশেখা দনপার কোঙ্কনি রেডিও প্রোগ্রাম। আর আমাদের সঙ্গে আজ আসা মাইকেল বুড, এমপি ফর মাউন্ট রস্কেল, আনি তাচা সঙ্গে চর্চা করুন গ্রেস সেরাও আনি জেভিয়ার ব্রিগেন্সে। সো উই ওয়ার অন দিস এডুকেশন সিস্টেম অ্যাজ সচ এন্ড হাউ ইট হ্যাজ সর্ট অফ নট ফিল দি রিকোয়ারমেন্টস অফ দি ইকোনমি অ্যাজ সচ। সো টেল মি, লেটস মুভ অন টু পাবলিক ট্রান্সপোর্ট। There is a big push about when you came in, or rather when your Labour Party came in, on public transport, different modes of transport, fast speed transport, transport to connectivities from the city to the airports and so on and so forth. What's happened to all those things? Where is it moving in which direction?
And I think I'll add one more thing to that. It seems like every time we have big public transport projects in New Zealand, we seem to have a 40 or 50% budget blowout, right? It happens consistently. How would the government protect against that?
Sure, good questions. Okay. Look, everyone in Auckland knows that we need to do something different with our transport system, because the congestion just keeps getting worse and worse as our population grows. And so Labor, and actually all of the parties of government when we were campaigning, were very clear that we need a shift towards high-quality, reliable public transport in the city, like you have when you visit many of the other great cities of the world and in all parts of the world. And so that'll mean a shift from just building more and more and more big roads to actually investing in the quality public transport that moves big numbers of people. So, you know, one train line can move the same amount of traffic as a six-lane motorway. That's the efficiency benefit you get with public transport. The main thing that we've done in this first year is, for the first time in history, basically, we have a fully funded, agreed 10-year transport investment plan between the government and Auckland Council. And it sets out exactly what we're going to spend the money on to make that change and how we're going to do it. And so it's going to be a shift to the modern high-quality public transport, getting electric train down to Pukekohe, building a light rail network which will move tens of thousands of people quickly and efficiently every single day, investing in the high-capacity bus lanes that we need, filling in the gaps in some of the roading network. We still do need new roads, places like Mill Road and Penlink up in Whangaparoa. So getting an integrated public transport network brought together. That's a $28 billion plan, and we can show exactly how we're going to pay for every dollar, and the work is now starting on it. Like any of these big infrastructure projects, it's a little while before you get them built because they're big projects, but we've now started that work, and I'm very optimistic that's going to make a big difference. In terms of the costs, it can be a challenge with all infrastructure projects, I'd say, not just public transport projects, that the costs can escalate. And I think the key thing is to do the planning right at the beginning, so that you really clearly understand the complexities you're going to face with the project, and that you then budget accordingly, and then you then have excellent project management of it to make sure that you keep to that through the process. The biggest blowouts occur when you don't do the planning and you find, for example, when you dig up the road, there's a whole lot of services there that you hadn't accounted for. That's what you need to cover off in your planning, and we certainly will be doing that with this program.
Okay. We move on to the next topic about strikes. We seem to be seeing a lot of strikes in this 1 year and stuff like that. So what's changed? Why are we having so many strikes? And why are people so unhappy about what they're getting paid? What's the government proposing to do about it?
Well, the simple answer is we've had 9 years of neglect in a lot of these areas. It's like your vegetable garden. If you neglect it, you won't have vegetables growing in there, you'll have weeds growing in there. And so we've had 9 years of neglect in all of these sectors, and people are angry and frustrated about that. And to be honest, I don't blame people, whether they're in the nursing workforce or the teaching workforce, for feeling that it's their time to get a fairer deal. And they know now that there's a government here that's willing to listen and is willing to make the investments in their sectors. So I think that's really what's sitting in behind this. And so we are going through a bit of a bump in the amount of industrial action. I don't think that it's necessarily always a bad thing that you have some strikes. They're a natural thing in a democratic society when a group of workers want to make their voice heard. Our approach is to sit down and work through it in a calm way. We did that with the nurses, for example, earlier this year. We had a day or two of strike action. We just kept working on it calmly, understanding the needs and putting the investment in. And again, because we've said we're going to invest in housing, health and education instead of tax cuts. We have got some ability to do that. It's going to take a little bit of time, but hopefully we'll get there with some of those other workforces soon too.
So I was chatting with a friend of mine who's a teacher, and she said to me, you know, we've had these options put in front of us, and the government keeps telling us there's no more money. However, they go and make an announcement about, $100 million towards the America's Cup. Is it the right approach when you're having a crisis with teachers and doctors and nurses?
Yeah. Well, obviously, we need to do more than one thing at once, and there'll always be other calls on government's expenditure. And it's just worth pointing out with the teacher settlement, we've now effectively got a $900 million settlement on the table. It is worth more than the three settlements that National put forward and were agreed by teachers during National's term in government. So the one settlement we've put forward is worth more than the three that National put on the table. So there's, pay increases of about $10,000 for the average teacher will play out over the course of this agreement if it's accepted. There's money for 600 new learning support staff to help with the students with special needs. Teachers are saying, hey, we need more support, particularly around classroom size and that kind of thing. So we will keep working on those things in good faith. But obviously, we've got to make sure that we manage the books responsibly as well. So that's the big balancing act we have as government, meeting those legitimate needs, but making sure we have money in the kitty for the other settlements. And also, if something goes wrong in the economy or we have another agricultural crisis, so we need to cover that. That's our challenge as government, but we'll just try and work it through in good faith.
Yeah, because the teachers, the trauma that it's a pleasure to teach, always a pleasure, and will always be a pleasure. It's a great service, but the constraints of numbers and so much of paperwork, and that does put a limitation. And you want to give out your best, but you really cannot give it out because of these. And that's why the numbers has to be addressed. I mean, looking after huge numbers, 40, 41 is massive, because the care and the type of education we get here is one-to-one. It's different from other countries, and therefore it's very personal. It's an engagement. We engage with every student. There's always a contact and engage, and we're building relationships, and we build very strong relations with our whole funnel. So it's very important that number thing is addressed.
Mm. No, thanks, Xavier, and thanks for the work that you and your colleagues do, because I know you say it's a rewarding job, but I know it's a hard job as well, and you're often having to be a teacher and a social worker and an organiser of your students' life and everything else that goes with it. So that's why we've got a lot of sympathy. We want to do this well. The numbers thing we're really aware of, and again, it comes back a bit to the neglect thing. By the time we got into government, the numbers coming through Teachers Training College had just shrunk dramatically, and we just haven't had the numbers coming through to actually keep up with the workforce demands with the growing population. So that's why we've got to do the work. And some of that we're trying to backfill again with reaching out to teachers in overseas countries to bring them in to help with that situation. But hopefully if we get this pay settlement right and some of the other policies right, we can get bigger numbers coming through in future years. 40-41 is clearly too big. But it's going to take a bit of time to undo that neglect of 9 years.
Mm-hmm.
So just going back on transport, you have a coalition partner in the Greens, and you have a big plan of how you want to fix the transport problem, not just in Auckland but in other cities as such. How are you going to balance between the greenhouse gas emissions, the type of transports that systems that you want, and the mandate that the Green Party is demanding of? Because fuel prices is like a yo-yo. When you introduced the commission, the prices have now started to soften off. So I don't know which way or what type of a policy is the government looking at.
Look, the long-term policy is that we want to shift to a carbon-neutral economy.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to do that if we're going to deal with the huge challenge of climate change. That is a real challenge now, but for our kids and our grandkids as well. And so we've got that goal of by 2030 reaching a net carbon zero economy, and that's across our energy system. It needs to be across transport. It needs to be across industry. And so there needs to be a shift in transport to meet that challenge to more public transport, and the shift that is currently happening from fossil fuel powered vehicles to electric vehicles. And there's work going on in that space as well. But particularly in the bigger cities, the public transport is more efficient and it's cleaner and greener. And actually, all parties in our government agree on that point, that we've got to make that shift. And it's actually been one of the good things about the government. People sometimes say, oh, having three parties in government, it makes it, you know, disorganised, or, you know, is that a good thing? I actually say, yes, it is, because you have three different perspectives around the table. You make better decisions when you're actually challenging each other's decisions and hearing alternative viewpoints. And I think that's the case in transport policy, and we've reached a point where we agree on the direction ahead. It's investment in rail, quality public transport, giving people transport choices.
So we've got a question from our viewer here.
Our listener.
And obviously, you all are doing a lot of work with teachers and stuff like that. But you have these amazing people who provide home-based care for early childhood and children and stuff like that. And that seems to be a sector that's really neglected. Are there any plans for the government to do something about making sure they come to, you know, a pay parity to some extent? Because they're doing exactly the same thing as teachers. They're shaping lives quite early in, you know, with a child. So I'm sure our listeners want to know a little about what the government plans to do with that.
Yeah, good question, and it's something that we're actively doing work on at the moment. You're dead right, and the correspondent is dead right. It's sort of been overlooked as a sector, but actually a huge number of kids, that's their early childhood education experience. So there's been very little in the way of sort of planning or oversight or regulation of that sector. We currently have a review that we've set up around that to say, have we got the right standards in place? Have we got the right oversight and support? And you know, you can imagine that will feed into a discussion as well about how does the remuneration play out as well.
Yeah, because what I understand is it's what, $5 or something for a child. I mean, that's not even minimum pay if the person's spending a day $5 an hour looking after a child.
And of course, this is also a sector, it's not like the government's directly paying the person. It's there's sort of an industry structure around there being a number of organisations which then you know, sort of have people under them. And so there's obviously a number of layers through which the money flows. So I think that's something else to look at in this field as well. But we acknowledge it's part of the sector and it needs to be looked at to make sure it's working as fairly as possible.
Mike, we are running out of time, and we'd just like to say a big thank you for taking time out and being with us and sharing your thoughts on what your government is doing at the moment.
So I have just one more question. I was reading your page and it said you listen to this unfashionable 70s music. That's what you like. So what's your favorite song, and why the 70s unfashionable music?
A CCR.
Yeah, I love a bit of CCR actually. Creedence Clearwater Revival. Great music. I don't know. I think when I was a boy growing up, my father always had it on radio, Hauraki. It was a station he always listened to, and I think it just kind of flowed over me and embedded itself. So I like, yeah, the Pink Floyd, CCR, Cream, Queen. So I'm going to go and see the new Queen movie soon. Love all that music. Back when music had drums and guitars and a great solo, I'm a little bit old-fashioned in that way.
That's wonderful. Thank you.
So we have England. CCR.
Ya ya ma ya 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 ya